The Darwin Awards, named after the eponymous Charles Robert Darwin, an English naturalist best known for his contributions to the science of evolution, are tongue-in-cheek honours conferred, often posthumously, on those who, by their actions, have deselected themselves out of the gene pool by death or sterility. The term survival of the fittest, often incorrectly attributed to Darwin, was coined by Herbert Spencer, 1809 to 1903, a brilliant polymath and contemporary of Darwin. After reading his On the Origin of Species, Spencer first used the phrase survival of the fittest in his Principles of Biology, published in 1864, in which he drew parallels between his own economic theories and Darwin's biological one. This survival of the fittest, which I've here sought to express in mechanical terms, is that which Mr. Darwin has called natural selection, or the preservation of favoured races in the struggle for life. Fitness, as applied to natural selection, is defined as the degree of success in reproduction. This is primary, albeit we are top of the evolutionary tree. For now, that is. If we strip away our mores, culture, philanthropy, aesthetics, history, and our inflated sense of self-worth, the sole purpose of human endeavour is to continue the species by reproduction. If that one endeavour fails, then all else becomes an irrelevance, because we will be extinct. Should mankind eventually muddle its way to oblivion, which, let's be honest, is attracting increasingly shorter odds, then there are those who consider it possible that the ensuing dominant species may be insects and small invertebrates. A bold proposition, yet the evidence is persuasive. Consider our limitations. First, our diet. Over a period of just a few thousand years, our digestive system has specialised to the extent that we cannot readily digest uncooked meat. The appendix, now vestigial and unnoticed except for when it becomes inflamed, once allowed us to digest cellulose. Hence, unlike many insects who still have the requisite enzymes in their digestive tract, we have long lost the ability to graze on wood. Our reproduction involves a mammalian placental system that, although protecting the unborn safely inside the mother, involves a gestation of 9 months to produce at very most a handful of offspring at a time. Our body temperature regulation mechanism means that without suitable clothing we are quickly prone to hypothermia at minus 10 degrees centigrade and uncomfortably hot above 30, giving us a puny survival range of just 40 degrees centigrade. Compare and contrast with insects and small invertebrates. Their ability to eat an extensive array of matter to survive long-term in extremes of temperature from the Arctic to Death Valley, and, most importantly, to reproduce in vast numbers in short order, make them prime candidates to successfully continue their species in a post-apocalyptic world devoid of humans. Here's food for thought, quite literally. In the immediate aftermath following the bombing of Hiroshima, cockroaches were found grazing in the rubble directly adjacent to Ground Zero. Meanwhile, back at the Darwin Awards. These recognise individuals, most of whom, it has to be said, are moronic, and whose demise by their sheer idiocy would be purple sad were it not so humorous. By self-removal, or so the theory goes, one more fruit loop is eliminated from the gene pool, thereby rendering it more fit for purpose as the progenitor for succeeding generations. All good knockabout stuff. Let's look at a few recent examples who have graced the ranks. In 2019, American Ronald Sawyer shot himself dead when he forgot that he'd installed a device for firing a gun at anyone who opened his door without invitation. He opened the door. In 2018, New Zealander Howard Miller, an experienced welder, inexplicably chose to mix his separate oxygen and acetylene supplies into the one tank. A deadly combination, no sooner he lit his nozzle than the flame went backwards into the tank and exploded. Thoughtfully, he had also decided to weld adjacent to a store of spirit cleaner. The resultant fireball destroyed houses for several blocks around and left little trace of Howard. And finally, to mercilessly hammer the point, in 2018, two Polish men were involved in a minor collision on a main road. The ensuing argument led to a brawl that spread into the middle of the busy highway, where both were oblivious to the oncoming truck. Originating in newsgroups sometime around 1985, the Darwin Awards were formalised in 1993 as a website where visitors can vote for their favourite candidate, and the publication of several books. Both elements were instigated by one Wendy Northcutt, a graduate in molecular biology from the University of California, Berkeley. The site has attracted its share of imitators, and many of the unconfirmed stories purporting to be Darwinian are urban myths. Hence, the rules of the Darwin Awards insist that verification is key. Alas, the awards have not noticeably helped diminish the propensity for humanity to act idiotically. No matter how many rules and regulations are invoked aimed at preserving life or preventing injury, there will always be someone who feels they know better, with catastrophic results. It is impossible to fully protect the foolish from themselves, but visionary legislators and philanthropists have still defied the odds in their efforts to do so, notably in the struggle against what they see as rogue industrialists. Acts accommodating factories, mines, explosives and employers' liabilities have been around for centuries. But arguably one of the most contentious contributions in recent years was the All-Embracing Health and Safety at Work Act of 1974. Contentious because it polarised opinion between those on the safety side who felt it was a landmark in protecting workers and placing obligations on employers to create a safe working environment, and the detractors who saw it as an unashamed extension of the nanny state. I also suspect an input of macho-fueled rebellion, whereby the kudos of doing the job the tough old way was threatened, and an inflexibility promulgated by awareness of what these interfering busybodies will come up with next, such as children being banned from playing conkers unless they wear goggles, office workers banned from putting up Christmas decorations, trapeze artists having to wear hard hats, pin the tail on the donkey declared a safety risk, banning candy floss on a stick. All and many more cited by critics of health and safety as serious infringements of our liberties. And all entirely false. In a classic exposition of an inaccuracy travelling halfway around the world before a truth has got its boots on, it is impossible to trace where some of these baffling myths originate. But they all have one crucial thing in common. They are most emphatically not enshrined in health and safety law. Unsurprisingly, the overseeing health and safety executive are not impressed. There are few greater myths than that health and safety has gone mad, says the executive. We've debunked some truly ridiculous misrepresentations of health and safety, including the banning of conkers and firemen's poles. We've scotched scare stories about excessive safety signs, rebutted rumours about onerous risk assessments, and kicked back at claims that kids need to be wrapped in cotton wool. This trivialisation concerns us. It confuses businesses about their responsibilities and workers about their rights. Now, in my efforts to remain impartial, I'm finding this a bit of a tricky one. I consider myself a libertarian, but conversely recognise the need to insulate the ill-prepared from themselves, which I accept sometimes might include me. But do we achieve this from legislation or education? I submit it is a combination of both. Many life skills are accrued as a consequence of one's upbringing, principally under the tutelage of parents or peers. So where does one draw the line between formal education and informal cognizance? Do I really need advice that a 20-feet-tall rickety ladder leaning perilously against a wall may not be safe to ascend? There are those who choose to take the risk rather than err on the side of caution, and for them, well, it's back to the Darwin Awards. It must be said that sometimes the imperative for legislation may be a result of self-fulfilling prophecy, or for reasons one could not have envisaged. CJD, mad cow disease, and more recently coronavirus, are the consequences of an interference in what hitherto had been a settled order of nature. I do not come to bury health and safety, nor do I come to praise it, but I do offer a defence of common sense and basic education. Our health and safety clearly requires a regulatory framework, yet I contend this has often overstepped the mark into the territory of personal responsibility, to the detriment of our initiative. It is the actions of zealots or the overcautious that grate on the sensitivities, and it may be easier to defray something on the specious excuse that health and safety legislation does not permit it. Oh, how often have I endured committees where creativity has been stifled at birth on the spurious grounds of contravening safety rather than formulating a risk assessment that identifies the hazards and presents practical solutions to mitigating them. This attitude has led to a near-universal epidemic of risk aversion to the point of madness, although it is not aided by a compensation culture of where there's blame, there's a claim. It is this over-the-top caveat that belittles the true health and safety message, and I have some random examples in front of me that I find especially irksome. Let's take a look. First of all, I have a packet of peanuts, the labelling of which declares contents, nuts, salt, etc. You get the picture. So far, so good. Until we come to the bit that states, this product may contain nuts. Really? What else was I expecting? And am I so ill-informed to need to be told, contents bleach, do not drink? But my favourite, for now, is a leaflet that I found inside a water bottle I recently purchased. It is written in no fewer than 6 languages and contains the usual advice on not putting it in a microwave, only wash it in soapy water, and so on. Fair enough. Until I get to the bottom of this lengthy multilingual liturgy and see entrapment hazard. Do not stick tongue down bottleneck. Injury can result. Now, come on. No amount of legislation and advice is going to prevent some buffoon, for reasons best known to themselves, doing exactly that. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Because they're out there, an entire cabal going out of their way to give common sense and reasonable precaution a bad name. So, stop and think. It may be dangerous, apparently. But if you must, then take solace that the honour of a Darwin Award could soon be all yours. Enjoy, and may those you leave behind continue to procreate.